Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, on the next Leonard Lopate show, a conversation with Andrew Bolton, curator of the wildly popular exhibition of Alexander McQueen's designs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, plus a look at the world of online dating. Today at noon on 93.9 FM and AM 820 WNYC. Many of you will recognize our next guest, John Prendergast, from his partnerships with international celebrity do-gooders, if you want to call them that, like George Clooney and Angelina Jolie. He's dedicated his life to ensuring basic human rights for the people in the most violent and unstable regions of Africa, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and northern Uganda. Prendergast is former head of African affairs for the National Security Council. He is co-founder of the Enough Project, an initiative to end genocide and crimes against humanity. He is also an author, most recently, of the memoir Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption. Prendergast wrote this book with Michael Maddox, a man who Prendergast considers family. The book details the journey of their relationship and highlights the importance of positive role models in the lives of young people. John Prendergast, so nice to have you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Brian.
Who is Michael?
Wow. That's one of the most important questions of my lifetime, which is, I was in visiting a friend of mine who was working in a homeless shelter. I was 20 years old. It's 1983. And these two little boys who were living in the shelter, literally out of plastic bags, hefty bags, carrying their belongings around from place to place every night with their family. These two kids come piling into the room, and we just start horsing around. And eventually I end up taking them to the library, trying to help teach them to read. And it becomes a bit of a routine, and eventually they become my little brothers. And 25, 6, 7 years later, we're still brothers.
As the book tells it, you bought the meals even though you had little money yourself. You invited them to spend the summer in your one-room apartment in Philly. These don't sound like things that most 20-year-olds would enjoy. At the time, did you know why you were doing all this?
No, and in fact, I didn't really know why I did all this stuff until I actually wrote my part of the book, because it's a dual memoir. Michael has half the book and I have half. And you know, in my part of the book, I have to go back and understand the motivations. Of course, my own self-perception was, I'm a heroic figure, someone who like did all these things for such noble reasons. And you know, at the end of the day, looking back and the torturous sort of past that I had and the upbringing, a lot of it was about filling holes in my own life. A lot of it was about trying to find meaning in my sort of existence, if you will. And I think that a lot of it was just trying to find my own way. And Michael and James, his little brother, were instrumental in that process.
How did Africa enter the picture?
A year after I met Michael, so now I'm 21 and fully engaged in the kids' lives. I was up one night, had played basketball all day and got hurt, was at this sort of ice pack on my ankle, and couldn't get up to change the channel. This is pre-remote control. At least I didn't have a remote control, my little black and white. And so I was watching a basketball game. Game went over, went off. I didn't feel like getting up to change the channel. And bam, this PSA, this public service announcement comes on. And all you can see are these Ethiopians, as far as the camera lens could stretch, just huddled over these little fires. They didn't even have tents, you know, in a refugee camp. And that was my first images of the Ethiopian famine, the great Ethiopian famine of 1983 to 85. And I was just blown away. And I felt, I've got to go there, find out and understand why this is happening and see whether my country, the United States of America, can possibly do something about
this. And ironically, while you had decided that spending time with Michael's family was one way to make a difference the previous year, the more time you began to spend in Africa, the less you had to be with Michael and his siblings. How did you rationalize these choices?
Yeah, I think that's the right word, rationalization, because, you know, at the end of the day, there was a choice, because I was investing my life in, which then became my vocation, in fighting human rights abuses in Africa and working for peace. And that required me to be over in Africa most of the time. And it required me to be less and less involved in the boys' lives. And if you're going to make the kind of substantial difference I was seeking to make in their lives, you couldn't just sort of hit and run every few months and hope that would stick. And so I believed that the seeds I was planting, even in those brief encounters, would hopefully germinate in some way in them in the way that they chose to live their life. But it turned out that the trajectory was not a straight line, particularly for Michael.
And it isn't for anybody almost ever, and in these very dramatic and important ways for you. And listeners, you know, we know that our listeners probably disproportionately are people who want to make a difference and try to make a difference. And I wonder if anybody listening right now, we've got just a few minutes to add phone calls to our time with John Prendergast. But have you had to make a similarly difficult decision about how to spend your time and money to improve the world? Have you had to decide whether to go small scale, maybe volunteer with some individuals like John and Michael, or big picture? Donate time or money to disaster relief or fighting world hunger. Let us know if you faced any of this, you know, big versus small decision making in your own life. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for John Prendergast, co-author with Michael Maddox of Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption. So in the book, Michael writes that if you hadn't been such an integral part of his life, he wouldn't have left his life dealing crack cocaine. He wouldn't have put down his gun. He might have ended up dead. On one level, this says great things about your sort of big brother, little brother relationship. On the other, it seems like this lifestyle could have been prevented entirely, maybe, if you had been there for him more often instead of going out to Africa so much. That's a huge burden, especially when you're not his father, so you don't have, you know, any official responsibility. But it sounds like it's something you struggled with.
Yeah, I mean, I walk around with a couple of anchors. They get lighter as the years go by. But one of the great regrets of my life is not having invested earlier, more deeply in that preventive mode. And as a mentor, as a tutor, as a big brother, big sister, all these different programs, even as teachers, we have that opportunity. It's so easy. You know, you can spend an hour or two a week or every other week with a kid in any one of these kinds of programs. And that connection that you're making, that role model you're presenting to that kid, can literally make the difference in that child's life. And it's true of Michael, even though I was probably the anti-big brother in terms of my coming in and out of his life and not being there for big events, it still, as he says, made a tremendous impact when the real decision, when the real fork in the road he was facing, he went the right way instead of the wrong way.
I think a lot of people who have the impulse to become, let's say, a big brother or do some kind of volunteering like that, when they think about it deeply, they actually recoil from it because they say, I don't want to be, you know, a tourist in some little impoverished urban kids' life and just wind up leaving them because ultimately I have to go back more to my own life.
That is absolutely correct. It's a correct perception. However, despite that, the longitudinal studies show, and these academics that have come in and looked at this over years and years, because there's now like 50 years of empirical evidence and data that you can look at, that even if it's a year or two that a person invests in a child's life, that year or two can have a incredibly overwhelming impact, positive impact on the choices the kid makes, the grades that they have in school, the relationships they're able to form, all of the kind of critical life choices that they end up making about use of drugs and other kinds of things. That investment, that someone actually cared enough about them to focus in on them, even if it's a year or two, that actually makes a big difference.
Jim in Spring Lake, trying to balance the small and the big. Jim, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Yeah, I do international labor rights work. I actually just got back this past week from a trip in Indonesia. I'm gearing up to head back there in August. And I have a three-year-old daughter, and I'm a single dad. So it's quite a balancing act, you know. And those weeks that I miss with my daughter when I'm over there doing the work that I feel called to do. It's tough. It's a real challenge at times.
Thank you very much. Maria in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes. I'm sorry. Good morning. Yes, I share the feelings of this gentleman because I did the same thing for a lady who has been getting pregnant and she started being so sick that she couldn't eat. So I quit my job in order to take care of the lady who's going to be having a baby.
You quit
and
your
cook,
job?
For her.
Yes?
I cook for her dinner, lunch, and breakfast. And then finally, I was praying so much for the baby that the baby was a beautiful, beautiful baby boy. And when the baby was born on August 2007. So I saw my job done. And I said, thanks, God, that I could do this.
What a wonderful story. How did you know the woman?
I'm sorry?
How did you know the woman?
Well, I was meeting her at the park because she was throwing up. And I took her to the apartment, and then she started telling me what she was having.
Maria, you are a hero, man. Wow.
That's remarkable. I mean,
you see a stranger barfing in the park, and you wind up taking them to your home and quitting your job to nurse her through a pregnancy. John, I don't think I've ever seen you speak to this before.
No. That's remarkable. And, you know, I think one of the things we've done is put up a little message board on a Facebook page that allows people to put their little stories of mentorship and support. That would be a great story to add, this unlikelybrothers.com. You just put your little story up there. It's a beautiful story, an inspirational story.
Right.
And I go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Maria, if you have internet access, go and put that at
unlikelybrothers.com.
And thank you for calling us with it. We've just got 2 minutes left, and because of your knowledge of Africa, I want to ask you an international politics question, war and peace question, really. On July 9th, South Sudan is going to split away to form a separate nation. People who have been following this know that a vote has gone on. There was a civil war. Then there was a vote to completely oversimplify the situation. Now there are rumors that war may break out between the new country and the old country, North and South Sudan. How is this change going to affect your program's goals for the nation? And why can't they just stop fighting with each other now that they're going to be two different countries?
We've invested a great deal of time and effort. The activist groups, the people that have cared for the last 8 years about the genocide in Darfur, the religious groups and student groups that have, over the course of the last 20 years, invested time and energy in trying to help build peace in southern Sudan. So it's all coming down to this present moment, July 9, when South Sudan becomes the newest country in the world, and it could be born in the context of war and famine. So we're working very hard to get President Obama and his administration to invest deeply in the peace process. And so that's another one you can get involved in. Enoughproject.org, you can find out what you can do. You can write your letter, you can send your emails, and actually make a difference. When citizens come together around these kinds of issues and say that it matters that America stands for peace, we can actually do it.
The book is called Unlikely Brothers, Our Story of Adventure, Loss, and Redemption. John Prendergast, maybe you've seen him in the media elsewhere for his partnerships with international celebrity do-gooders like George Clooney and Angelina Jolie, such a force in his own right. See, I didn't even ask you any, like, what's George Clooney like questions, right?
It's the first and only time I've ever escaped.
And,
don't do it. Resist.
John Prendergast will be talking to NBC's Ann Curry if you want to see him live at McNally Jackson, the bookstore. That's the Prince Street.
52
Prince Street, and that's going to be tomorrow.
Today,
1 o'clock. So basically you're going there from here.
Right.
1 o'clock this afternoon, John Prendergast with NBC's Ann Curry at Jackson McNally, 52 Prince Street at 1 o'clock. Such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian, very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.